kinds of esteemed people.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency to order. Committee, we have three bills up today for public hearing, one for work session. We're going to start out with Senate Bill 558A, and so I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 558A. And if I could have Senator Rosenbaum and Senator Boquist introduce this legislation for us.
Thank you, sir.
Bob, do you want to go ahead and give us a brief, I know it's not a very brief summary, but tell us what the bill is about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 558 expands the existing foreclosure mediation program to include judicial foreclosures and makes changes to the structure of the mediation program. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And good afternoon. Welcome. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Diane Rosenbaum, representing Senate District 21 in southeast, a little of northeast Portland and Clackamas County. And I'm very pleased to appear today in support of Senate Bill 558A. And the fact that there's an empty chair in between Senator Boquist and me is symptomatic of the fact that the three chief sponsors, who are usually the three musketeers on this bill, are only two musketeers today, because Senator Lee Beyer, who's been working very hard on the bill you see before you, is celebrating the birth of a grandchild, and so he could not be with you today. This bill, which you're looking at, has had very strong bipartisan support, and it's the result of a lot of hard work to come before you in the form that it is today. If you were here previously, you'll remember that we earlier passed another bill, Senate Bill 1552, that set up a mediation program so that homeowners could have a face-to-face meeting with their lender and attempt to work out an alternative to foreclosure. That program actually went through not only legislation, but rulemaking, and an entire program was set up. And then meanwhile, some other events overtook the program, and most foreclosures ended up going through the court system. So the bill that you have today actually delivers the promise of that earlier bill by making the mediation program a part of the process of alternatives to foreclosure, whether it's a judicial or a non-judicial foreclosure. As you know, we started to have a problem in this regard in Oregon several years ago. We were a little bit behind the curve of the rest of the country. You can probably remember a time when other states were having massive waves of foreclosure, and it still hadn't hit Oregon. But when it hit here, it hit with a vengeance, and it's still not over, so that we have far too many homeowners who are at risk of losing their homes. And in fact, today, this is approximate, but we know that one out of 13 homeowners are at least 1 month behind on their mortgages. There are 132,000 homeowners who are underwater on their mortgages, meaning they actually owe more on their mortgage than the home is worth. So clearly, the help that this bill will provide is help that's needed by far too many Oregonians who are struggling. And by acting and passing this bill as quickly as possible, we'll be able to take the program that we set up that is fine-tuned in the bill that you see before you and provide this mediation as part of the working out of alternatives to most of the homeowners who need this help. So I think we would all agree that keeping your home is really part and parcel of being able to survive in any circumstances, and particularly in an economy that still is recovering from the worst recession since the Great Depression. No family wants to face the tragedy of losing a home. This bill will provide real, meaningful help for many, many Oregonians who are desperately in need of it. The bill passed with strong bipartisan support. You see that today with the two of us sitting before you, and I'm very pleased to be able to join Senator Boquist in commending the bill to you and hope you will be able to act on it quickly. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brian Boquist, Senate District 12, pinch hitting for both myself and Senator Byers. As Senator Beyer has said, this is a very simple concept. That's why I have gray hair now. All we're asking is for people to sit down at the same table as representatives, you know that you have a meeting every 15 minutes, so it wouldn't be overly difficult. But having said that, we've been at this a while. As the chair knows, some of the previous discussions have been challenging. We came into the session thinking there would be three issues: technical fixes, expansion of the program to keep stuff out of court and MERS, and then we thought there would be three bills, and then there was one bill, and the MERS issue isn't even on the table that's here. But again, it comes back to a very simple concept. The basic idea is to get the same people that are decision makers in the room, have a meeting, and if it works out, it works out. As I said, I came to this place with nice hair, and now I have gray hair. I have spent more time negotiating and in more rooms negotiating this issue than any other issue in my legislative history. It's not a perfect product, and I think in the Senate sometimes we turn around and say the best bipartisan is where everybody's equally upset with both sides of the issue, but it will work, and it's a way forward for the system. We'll let you determine, because you are the upper house, there's 60 of you and 30 of us, so there's more of you. We'll let you determine, you know, the fate and what you're going to do with the bill. I would only tell you that it was quite challenging on our side to get everybody on the same sheet of music. I have, again, never been in so many meetings where I was absolutely convinced all six or eight people in the room absolutely understood exactly the same thing, only to find out, and they weren't lawyers, by the way, that there were 12 different interpretations from the six of them 2 days later. So here we are. I wish you the best of luck with it. It is a process that we need to continue to go down the road with, and it's yours.
Yeah, right. I'm not sure I want to ask questions.
I don't want to touch that.
Questions from the committee.
When will Senator Byer be back?
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And as you well know, you were involved in some of these. So you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do. And I really appreciate all the work that you've done. And I know it's not been an easy subject matter to get done. And so seeing it come out with such bipartisan support really, you know, does make us at least look at it with a different light, for sure. So I appreciate you taking your time today and introducing the bill, and we'll hear some other testimony and take a closer look at the bill. Thank you so much, and have a great afternoon.
Thank you.
And up next, I'd like to have Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum and her able-bodied assistant.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you.
Back to the committee. And if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Very nice to be back. Thank you, Chair Hulvey and members of the committee. I'm Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, and I have with me Mike Niemeyer, Assistant Attorney General, who has been responsible on the DOJ side for the mediation program thus far, along with others, but he's taken the lead. So I asked him to sit with me today and keep me honest, and if there are questions that are too hard for me, I'll certainly turn to him if that's agreeable with you.
I'm actually our ADR coordinators, Mike.
Thank you. Yeah. If we accept the premise that shelter, a roof over one's head, is a right and not a privilege, losing one's shelter without due process, but rather surrounded by confusion, delay, and unfairness, makes the issue that we're about today the consumer protection issue of our time. The Department of Justice devotes significant staff and attorney time to legal issues related to the mortgage foreclosure crisis, and we're dedicated to doing so until Oregonians facing the loss of their homes are treated fairly and given every opportunity possible to keep their families sheltered from actual storms, as well as from the tsunami of side effects that occur when a person loses his or her family home. For these reasons, I strongly support the proposed legislation before you today. I came into this office 11 days before the mediation program under Senate Bill 1552 went into effect. I embraced this program wholeheartedly, excited about the immense impact it would have on Oregon homeowners. Countless and tireless hours had been put in by many, including mortgage service providers, ensuring that the program was ready to go live, drafting and finalizing the administrative rules, training the mediators, obtaining qualified housing counselors, and publicizing the program. On July 10th, 2012, we were Ready, set, go. But for various reasons, the program was not able to take off in the way we had planned. And I'm not here to point fingers, but only to point out the opportunity we have today to get it right, to make this program work, and to ensure that Oregonians have a fair chance of staying in their homes. I also want to note that, and this was mentioned, of course, by the testifiers before me, that this is urgent legislation, both in terms of the need and also in terms of the need to move quickly. Each day that passes without a full and functional foreclosure mediation program for both non-judicial and judicial foreclosures means more Oregonians are losing their homes without the opportunity to talk things through meaningfully with their mortgage service provider. And because this is a fee-driven mediation program, every day of delay in its implementation will ultimately mean higher costs to the state of Oregon, as our trained mediators are forced to wait to continue their vitally important work. It's not enough that this proposed bill becomes law. I urge that it become law as soon as possible. Just for some brief background, as I'm sure you're all aware, there's been a drastic increase in foreclosures over the past several years, and you just heard from Senator Rosenbaum some of those statistics. Consumer advocates estimate that we're probably about halfway through the crisis, and it will likely continue for another 5 years. But really, we have no way of knowing how long it's going to continue. We do know the current system's not working and is inherently unfair to homeowners. Lenders continue to delay in responding to homeowners. Homeowners feel they're getting the runaround still and receiving sometimes misinformation and sometimes no information at all. The DOJ received nearly 800 complaints along these lines from homeowners in 2012, an all-time high, all of which confirm these practices and demonstrate that these problems are not simply going away. This crisis necessitated the creation of the Foreclosure Avoidance Mediation Program. And the program recognized and attempted to remedy these issues while at the same time not requiring loan modification, principal forgiveness, or interest rate reduction. All that's required is a face-to-face meeting in order to try and find some common ground between the lender and the homeowner. We've learned a lot under this system, and we need Senate Bill 558 to fix a few unforeseen loopholes. First, we need to close the judicial foreclosure loophole. At the time of the passage of Senate Bill 1552, the vast majority of foreclosures were carried out through the non-judicial foreclosure process. Accordingly, 1552 only required mediation in the non-judicial foreclosure process. But since the operative date of the mediation program, again, for a variety of reasons, lenders have overwhelmingly transitioned to judicial foreclosure, bypassing the mediation program entirely. For example, in the context of our civil enforcement of tax liens at DOJ, we have been receiving notice of more judicial filings per month than we used to get in an entire year. So Senate Bill 558 closes this loophole and ensures that all homeowners will have an opportunity for mediation before any type of foreclosure occurs. It doesn't distinguish between non-judicial or judicial. It just simply has to occur before foreclosure, before the filing, or whether it's a notice of foreclosure under non-judicial or whether it's an actual court filing under judicial. Second, Senate Bill 558 clarifies what 1552 meant by an at-risk borrower, a term that was not defined. Under Senate Bill 558, homeowners may proactively seek a third-party facilitated dispute resolution conference, which is really the same thing as a mediation. We're now calling it a dispute resolution conference, with their lender if the homeowner meets with a housing counselor and the housing counselor certifies that one of two things, either that the homeowner is more than 30 days in default on their loan, or the homeowner has a financial hardship that the housing counselor believes may qualify them for foreclosure avoidance mediation. This clarification will ensure that those who are entitled to mediation will be given the opportunity to participate in one. Third, Senate Bill 558 gives the DOJ additional enforcement powers. Of the 333 requests for mediation that we have received by at-risk homeowners under this previous or current legislation, lenders have failed to respond to 93% of those requests. We need a mechanism to enforce the law when lenders exhibit a clear pattern of noncompliance. Senate Bill 558 gives us that mechanism. Finally, Senate Bill 558 will ease the burden on our already overburdened court system. I don't think I need to say any more about that. We're all quite aware of that situation. So Senate Bill 558 benefits all of Oregon. A third-party facilitated process will help prevent foreclosures. It will help Oregonians hold on to their largest single financial asset, and it will help stabilize the state's struggling housing market. We already have the infrastructure to efficiently and effectively handle a high volume of these cases, and we are ready to move quickly to implement the program improvements in Senate Bill 558. This is the consumer protection issue of our time, and I urge you to vote in favor of Senate Bill 558. Thank you.
Did you want to testify or just answer questions?
I'm just here for your questions.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Richardson, excuse me.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Attorney General, for your remarks. You threw me when you said shelter is a right, and I've been thinking about that ever since because I'm sure you know the Constitution better than I do, and if shelter is a right, then I assume you would think that food and clothing would also be rights. Food, clothing, shelter, transportation, health care, I mean, all these are all very important, and if they're all rights, then who's responsible to pay for those rights and so forth? Anyway, I don't expect an answer. I just would think that you'd be cautious in stating what is a right unless you can really back that up, because I don't think that, we're still a free country and we're still responsible for ourselves, and I understand the housing crisis that we're in and the foreclosure issue and the consequences of people losing their homes. I fully understand that. Also, when you said that the system is inherently unfair to homeowners, I think that that may be the case in some homeowners, but there are a number of homeowners who have, with full understanding of what they were doing, got into situations where they bought homes that they couldn't afford in a circumstance or things changed in their lives where they lost their job and so forth. That also doesn't affect the reality that they have to have a place to live and all of that, and this bill is seeking to address some real issues that are of vital importance. I guess the rhetoric kind of caught me there because we're trying to deal with the reality that there is a lending market and there is a homeowner's market, and they both have issues that have to be addressed because it's part of the whole system, and if this bill will help address those in a way that recognizes the issues and needs and realities of both sides of this very important issue, then I think that that's probably a more fair approach than to merely view those that are in foreclosure for a number of different reasons as if they're the victims of something that was beyond their control, and it may have been, but it may have been bad judgment and other things as well.
Sure.
Anyway, so just
thank you,
just kind of
Representative
comment.
Richardson, and I certainly didn't intend for it to come across as one-sided as perhaps it may have to you, and I was not referring to the Constitution, so I appreciate your clarification. It was really a way to get your attention, and I guess
5 minutes, I was going, right. But anyway, that's a different issue.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's not divert too far from foreclosure. Representative Doherty.
Okay, and I've got a quick comment. First of all, I'd like to, constituents that I've helped the foreclosures, the DOJ has been wonderful with helping the constituents that are literally at the end of their rope because they haven't been able to get an answer from anybody. And so the help that they did and the personal help and the quickness is truly appreciated by a lot of people. So I commend the DOJ.
Thank you, Representative.
Other question, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good seeing you, Madam Attorney General. Does Senate Bill 558, when it uses the term beneficiary, does that apply to beneficiaries of a private sales contract as well as what we might traditionally think from a credit union or a bank?
Let me turn to
I'd leave that
Mike
to our
here.
Consumer advocates or Janet to testify.
Yeah, we, following our testimony, we're going to have some sort of technical testimony, and if it would be agreeable with the chair and Representative Smith, I'd like to leave that question for them to answer so that we don't mess that one up.
Okay, so I have that question out there, and then the follow-up I would have with that for whoever this person is if it does, how do we plan to educate all those folks out there who have private sales contracts as to what the new statute reads? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, and this may be appropriate for you or for someone afterwards, so just another question out there. One of the three things in which you said this improved on the bill from last year was defining a at-risk homeowner who may not have already gotten a foreclosure notice, and I remember a lot of discussion about that last year, and it seemed to be very broad, so I'm wondering whether this, in your opinion, broadens that definition or actually narrows it or just clarifies it so there's no question about it.
No.
To me, it felt like it was narrowing it to the two definitions or two possibilities that you gave, whereas I thought it was anyone who was worried that they might be at risk of foreclosure, so I actually thought it was broader in last year's. And I just wonder what the experience has been over the last year for the people that come and testify after.
Thank you, Representative Kenny Geyer. And again, I think there might be some follow-up, but what I would say in response is that it is an attempt to clarify a term that was not defined, and I think that it actually may have contributed by not defining it to the lack of responsiveness on the part of the lenders, perhaps due to no fault of their own. There was a misunderstanding, perhaps, of what that term meant. So if we can, instead of using that term, and that term is no longer in the bill, to my understanding, it simply refers to the opportunity for the homeowner to have a chance to request a mediation if he or she meets that those two criteria. And so in that sense, it is narrowing, but I think it's also clarifying in a way that will be helpful to all sides.
Okay. Thank you. So, Chair, the Representative Kenny Geyer. So as you'll hear from others.
And if you could introduce yourself for the record.
And for the record, my name is Mike Niemeyer. I'm the ADR coordinator for the Department of Justice. As you hear from others, the an integral part of the program is access to housing counselors. And so the what we've been referring to as at-risk homeowners would need to contact a housing counselor to meet with that person and then have a note or certificate from that housing counselor indicating that they are behind in their payments or they're at risk of falling into default on that loan. And that's a really important piece that, again, it gets to the information that the homeowner may need in terms of whether they might be realistic in seeking some kind of workout plan or not. So that's a really integral part of this. And so that's the vetting that would take place in terms of homeowners determining whether they're eligible to participate in the program.
Thank you. Other questions? So, Attorney General Rosenblum, you mentioned the issue about the lack of response, I guess, to the mediation requests. It was 93% from the lenders. Were they able to express other reasons why the lack of a response?
Well, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, let me clarify that the 93% pertained, I believe, to the at-risk category, and I think that my explanation for that perhaps apparent misunderstanding as to what was an at-risk, was it at risk of being non-judicially foreclosed? Because if there wasn't an intent to non-judicially foreclose, then perhaps they weren't, in fact, at risk, even if they thought they were. So I don't know why that number was so high, and I think you'd perhaps have to ask those who did not respond. We never really fully understood that, but that's part of the reason why I think this revision will be helpful. Then we will no longer, kind of be scratching our heads wondering why there aren't responses.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarity. Any other questions? I want to thank you so much for coming before us, and I want to thank the Department of Justice for its participation in trying to make this program work. Obviously, it's a needed program to help serve Oregonians. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We look forward to participating.
So up next, I have Sybil Hebb and Emily Remian. Probably said that wrong.
Maybe it's Alan's fan club.
Groupies.
Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here in support of Senate Bill 558A on behalf of the Law Center. I very much appreciate the incredible work of the sponsors of this bill and the work that went into getting us to this point, and I appreciate the attention of this committee on this important issue. So thank you. As you know, the Law Center provides legal assistance to low-income Oregonians. Our clients are living at 125% of the federal poverty level. They did not used to include homeowners for the large extent. Over the last 5-10 years, that has changed. And with the foreclosure crisis, we are seeing a significantly increased number of people who were formerly middle class now struggling to maintain their basic standard of life and their ability to keep their families in their homes. And we're facing people who are struggling with or dealing with people who are struggling with foreclosure. And the instance of those questions and those struggles coming through our hotlines and into our offices has increased dramatically over the years. And that's why we are so concerned about this crisis, like the rest of our communities, and trying to find ways to help people respond. As we have seen, and I believe some of the previous witnesses have described, in previous years, maybe in about 6 months ago, there was a little bit of a drop-off in foreclosure filings. That is no longer the case. Right now, recent statistics from the Department of Justice show that foreclosure filings are happening at about a 1,300 rate per month in this case, and that's been on a steady escalation. We expect it to keep going for a little while and top out. We're a little bit worried that there's a new wave of foreclosures coming, and as you're aware, there have been federal aid programs that have expired. Unemployment rates are still not where we'd like them to be. And so for people who have been able to maintain their homes through those aid programs but still have not yet been able to get back into the workforce, we're worried that those cases are coming down the pike. So this is an issue that still very much requires our presence and our attention. We agree that there is the question of sort of how did this happen and where did this come from and who's to blame. That's a broad and widespread question. There are many, many answers to that question. That's not what this is about. What we see from our perspective, this program is about making sure that both sides have access to an opportunity to sit down and figure out if there are alternatives to foreclosure that work for both sides. So the bill's not in our mind, and it isn't in practicality, about coming up with a modification. It's not about success being staying in a home. That may be the case for some people where that's appropriate. It may absolutely not be the case. And if that's not the case, then there are many other alternatives that may help avoid the necessity of litigation and actually going through the foreclosure process. For example, the parties could agree to a short sale. They may be able to agree to a deed in lieu of foreclosure. Maybe there's a cash for keys settlement that might help negotiate a graceful exit so that the family can move forward in a way that's sustainable for them and get their family out with the minimum amount of disruption to both parties. That saves the necessity of going through the litigation process for the lender in that circumstance. So I just want to be very clear that for us, this is about sitting down and making sure that the parties have the right paperwork in front of them, an opportunity to actually look at that and review that, with the opportunity for the borrower to have seen a housing counselor ahead of time before that takes place, so that they've got some assistance in getting their paperwork organized. It's a very overwhelming process. We continue to hear people, and I think it's a management issue. We continue to hear people who they can't get through to somebody on the phone. If they do, it's not the same person they're talking to the next day. Paperwork gets lost in the translation. Borrowers are struggling because they don't understand the documents that are in front of them. It's a morass. And sitting down with the paperwork in front of you with some assistance changes that drastically. 25 other governments have these kinds of programs in place. They've been very successful, and they've negotiated good outcomes for both sides. You'll hear more about those details from people who will follow after me. The Attorney General did a fantastic job of summarizing the basic principles or elements of the bill. There's a one-page document that I believe has been passed out to you that illustrates the things that we think are the most substantive elements of the change that is being accomplished by 558. And then on the back of that sheet, there is a time frame that can kind of help you go through the step-by-step process. Just a couple of highlights that I wanted to hit that hadn't been previously mentioned. The Attorney General mentioned that this new program will take place prior to the filing of the foreclosure action. It's something that must be accomplished first before an action would get initiated. And I just wanted to hit on that for just a minute, because that's incredibly important in that it if the case is resolved, it removes the necessity of going through the court system, which removes the barrier or the burden on the courts. That 1,300 number will come down, which is good for our court systems. It's good for the sheriffs who conduct those sales. So it reduces the burden on the system that way. So that's one benefit. The other benefit is that it is a slightly less of a credit hit on the borrower who's going through that process. And so that makes it a little easier for them to move on. Another piece of 558, which was a significant compromise in the Senate negotiations, is about the exemption. Representative Smith, you asked whether land trust contracts were covered by this bill, and I will flag for Ms. Harpster, who's the certified smart person on this issue, but I would say that the bill as drafted applies only to residential trust deeds. It should not cover that that circumstance. And there is an exemption. Even within residential trust deed foreclosures, there is an exemption in the bill. That's true under the current law, 1552. This bill reduces the exemption a little bit. Frankly, not to consumer protection advocates' satisfaction. And so I think there's been no secret about that in the discussions, and we just wanted to flag that issue for you. We advocate passage of the bill as quickly as possible without amendments, so we're not seeking an amendment on the exemption, but we did want to flag that there is a concern about whether the exemption will inadvertently and unintentionally leave some national large servicers out of the coverage of our bill, which will leave a significant number, if it comes true, of homeowners who would deserve and benefit from the protection of the mediation program. And so under the current law, lenders who initiate 250 foreclosure filings in a year or fewer are exempt from the mediation requirements. This bill would reduce that number to 175 foreclosure filings in a year, and that's a good positive step. But the intent of that exemption really is around making sure that the credit unions and the community banks, the really small practitioners who are more likely to be servicing their own loans, more likely to have someone at the other end of the phone, be here in Oregon, aware of who their consumers are and able to work with them. Those are the folks that we were intending to exempt. And at 175, it's hard to know who's going to be there. We're worried it may be too wide a net. So I just wanted to flag that. And again, the concern there is because of the benefit that we want to deliver to both sides and of the consumers who we believe will be positively impacted by passage of this bill. To answer Representative Kenny Geyer's question about the at-risk borrower definition, and I see my summary includes that term, which it probably shouldn't because it's no longer in the bill, but I've sort of gotten used to thinking about it that way, so I apologize. It does narrow the definition and make it more definitive. And I think that's beneficial to both sides. If you don't want to be seeking something that you're not sure you're qualified for, you're entitled, you know, you have the right to. And on the other side, lenders want to know, you know, what their standards are. And so the bill does three things. It narrows the definition so that you're either 30 days in default or more. That's easy to determine. Or you are determined, certified by a housing counselor to be someone who is suffering from financial hardship. That's an analysis that counselors make all the time for their clients. Emily can tell you more about that. And that's something that's a term that's used by many of the federal loan modification programs. So it's sort of an industry term. And the requirement that the borrower must see the housing counselor before they can access that part of the bill is really just a great process step in making sure that they're prepared and ready to go and everybody knows if they qualify or not. The other piece I wanted to touch on briefly is that Senate Bill 558 provides an important measure of enforcement. The Attorney General mentioned that that's an important piece of the bill. And I wanted to say when the bill started out, we drafted it specifically in a way that provided the AG with the ability to file an enforcement action under the UTPA. We specifically did not include a private right of action for individuals because we understood that there was concern about that, and we wanted to come forward with a proposal that made sure that there was a way to ensure compliance. We had concerns about that under the current bill, but also did not trigger great concerns about the program. We further amended in the on the Senate side to specify specifically that that provision did not provide a private right of action. So that was another piece that was put in the, I think we came to the -20 amendments on the Senate side. So, but for borrowers and for consumers who are moving through this and who are unable to get a response, and if the beneficiary did not participate as required, it's just important to make sure that there's a way to ensure that compliance. And that statute allows the Attorney General to investigate and have a negotiation with the beneficiary, come up with an agreement of compliance. If that fails, there's the authority to move forward with litigation. So we think that's a reasonable and very important part of the bill. Just a couple of quick technical pieces to mention before I move on. And there were a number of back and forths. The bill includes some provisions around what kinds of documents need to be provided by both sides, by the borrower so that the lender can examine, by the lender so that the borrower can examine, so that the mediator can look at all of that and help the parties come to some sort of a negotiated agreement, if that's possible. There was a lot of give and take and back and forth. The documents that are required in the bill have been significantly narrowed through those discussions in a way that still preserves the essential critical elements that the borrowers need, but also addressed the lender's concerns about that burden. We've simplified some of the notice provisions, clarified that the Attorney General has rulemaking authority to make sure that this process works. There's been an advisory committee in place to implement Senate Bill 1552. We expect that will continue. In my experience, from my perspective, that's been a great way for all of the sides to get together and figure out how the rules should look, how the program should work. We have made some amendments at the lender requests to the dual track provisions. That was a protection that was passed in 1552 that required if a bank has made a determination that a borrower is not in compliance with a modification or an agreement, or that a borrower does not qualify for a modification. If they make that determination, they need to let the borrower know that they have made that determination. That's very relevant to the borrower in terms of figuring out, am I still in this modification process? Are we still talking here, or is it over? And it's relevant to know, am I, you know, complying with the modification, or is foreclosure moving forward? So that's an important notice. That notice is retained in this bill, but it's streamlined. There's some protections for the banks put into place so that if they substantially comply, as opposed to strict compliance with the plain language requirement of the bill to explain what the beneficiary of the bank's determination is. Was helpful. We reduced the statute of limitations at bank request. So there are significant amendments here that were made to ensure that we could move forward. There were also some caps put on fees. There's one question that I mentioned to the trustees that I would put on the record, and so I understand that there was a question about application of the bill. We read the bill, and I spoke with legislative counsel, and I think it's clear in the language of the bill that it does not impact cases that are filed prior to the effective date. So if you file a foreclosure yesterday or you file one tomorrow before the bill takes effect and you meet the requirements of the current law, Senate Bill 558 does not change that and does not implicate that in any way. Another question that's come up is related to the certificate of compliance. And again, I think the bill is clear on this, and I just want to put on the record that it's also our intent. Certificate of compliance is what you get. What the beneficiary, what the lender gets if they have complied with the law, that's what it sounds like. You get that in three different circumstances. One is if the borrower does not pay the fee in time, then the resolution conference is canceled, the process is canceled, and a certificate of compliance gets issued right away to the bank. So the borrower must pay the fee within 25 days of receiving the notice of that requirement. And if they miss it, then a certificate of compliance goes to the bank. The bank can move forward with its judicial or non-judicial foreclosure. The other circumstance in which you would get a certificate of compliance is if the borrower does respond, you do go through the meeting, and it's completed. At the end of that process, the service provider provides a certificate of compliance to the bank. That certificate of compliance, the bill requires, it lasts for a year. It must be unexpired prior to the filing or at the time of the filing of the foreclosure. And that's the requirement. That means, in practical effect, that the foreclosure that the bank wants to move forward with must be filed within a year of the completion of the mediation. If the certificate of compliance expires during the pendency of that case that is filed, that's okay. There's nothing that prohibits that. There's nothing that requires that the foreclosure be completed at the end of before the certificate of compliance expires. So I just wanted to put that on the record, that that's the way we read the bill, and that's what I believe the bill says. And I guess I would close by saying that experience in other states, the limited experience with this program here in this state from those lenders and borrowers who have proceeded with the program through mediation, have shown that it's just a common sense solution. It's a good way to get outcomes that work for borrowers as well as for banks. It's a good way to reduce the burden on the court system. It's a good way to reduce burdens on our communities. And so we very much appreciate the attention of this committee and of the sponsors and those who've worked so hard to put this together, and we really hope that we can move forward with this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate your very thorough explanation of the bill. I'm sure we probably have a few questions. In interest of time, I notice Senator Brzezinski's come in to testify on another bill. Are you fine sitting for a few minutes? Okay, questions, or should we listen to the other testifier? Let's go ahead and get some questions out, because that was a pretty long piece of testimony.
Question on fees, if I missed it. What are the fees on both sides?
Chair Holvey, Representative Kenny Geyer, and I'm sorry that I promised everybody I would take less time than I apparently have, so I apologize. The fees are capped for borrowers at $200. The Attorney General has the authority to set those by rule, and the fees for the beneficiary for the bank are capped at $600. And again, the AG has the ability to set those by rule. They're currently set by rule under 1552, I believe at $175 for the borrower and at $450 for the banks, but I will let someone correct me if that's not the case, but I believe that's right.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a really tough issue, because on the one hand, we have all these first-time home buyer programs, and we have VA loan programs, and we have this loan program and that loan program doing everything we can to encourage people to get into a home. And then on the other hand, we have this program that really tells lenders, you're going to add an additional responsibility on it. And what it's going to do is it's going to tell mortgage lenders in the private sector that, you know, you better tighten it up a little bit. And I'm not sure that's bad, but I think that's going to be the cause. As I look at the exemption piece, I understand the 175. That intellectually, that makes sense to me. What I'm worried about is I think it's the way we're going to document it through a sworn affidavit to the Attorney General is very clunky for the mom and pops out there who have one or two private homes that they're selling on private contract. And as I read this, they're now going to have to submit a sworn affidavit to the Attorney General. And so the question I have in my mind is, what is the Attorney General going to do with thousands of these sworn affidavits from mom and pa in Heppner who want to go through a foreclosure process but want to be exempt? I wonder if there's another way to get to this. This committee, a couple weeks back, we limited the number of real estate transactions to 3 per year before you had to be licensed. I wonder if we could have additional language in here that says if you're going to sell or if you're going to be involved in less than 3 or 5 foreclosures in a given period of time, you don't have to do anything. Because the concern I have is if you go to page 12 of this bill and you look at a beneficiary that fails, in reading lines 2 through 5, a beneficiary that fails to substantially comply could potentially be hit with a $500 fine. And so I'm trying to figure out, not from the big lender perspective, I'm not worried about that, I'm trying to figure out Ma and Pa in Pendleton, Oregon, how do we deal with them?
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, just 2 things. One is that the lines that you're looking at on line 12, on page 12, the lines 2 through 5, that actually doesn't apply to the mediation program. That's just if you are a lender who has entered a modification, and either that modification has been violated or not complied with, or you've determined that the person is not eligible for a modification. That's where that sanction applies. So your concern, though, your question, is if I understand it, is about how does the individual small person just, you know, figure out how to file the affidavit
does one
exemption.
Or two, may do one or two a year.
And my answer to that is that the Attorney General has done a great job of making that process incredibly easy. There's a website, and I believe Janet Borth from the Department of Justice is here, and she can give you more information. She'll be testifying later. There's a website. The form is on the website. You can download it at your computer at home. It's very easy to fill out. And then you can submit it back electronically.
How do you suppose the ma and pa in Prineville, who is 75 years old, is going to know to go to the Attorney General's website to fill out this affidavit?
Chair Holby, Representative Smith, maybe I'm getting in over my head here, and I'm going to defer to Kelly Harpster, who will know a little bit more about the dynamics of this. But the affidavit of exemption is required to be filed along with the paperwork when you initiate your judicial proceeding, or when you finalize your notice of default if you go through the non-judicial process. And so there are access points. If you're filing paperwork, you're getting that from somewhere, and this will now it'll just be part of that process. So you're having to initiate a legal process, period, and so this is now just part of that. So I think that's my best answer to your
Thank
question.
You.
That you may
so, Mr. Chair, I'll be done asking questions. I really, really want to help on Senate Bill 558. I just think if we could figure out that one or two mom-pa transaction piece, I could get there to support this, but thank you.
Other questions? I hate to do this to the committee, but I think that I'm going to bring you back up and temporarily close this public hearing. So I know a senator is here to testify on a different bill, and we're going to switch gears here for a few minutes, listen to his testimony, and then we'll get back into the foreclosure. So try to keep your mind flexible. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 558. And open, Senator, which bill would you like to testify on, or both?
Both of them.
I will concurrently open Senate Bill 574 and Senate Bill 525.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you very much for taking the time and giving me the opportunity to present two bills to you. I'll start off with the Senate Bill 574A, since that was the one the Chair opened up with. This bill here will actually authorize basically parents or guardians of minors to freeze credit reports and protect our protected persons. In the event that the protected person does not have a credit report, then under Senate Bill 574A, the credit reporting agency would basically set up a protective record for that individual and freeze it at that point. The reason this came forward was a constituent contacted our office because we had a breach in a computer system at the 4J school district in Eugene, where students' information was unfortunately hacked into and was taken from the depository that they had within the computer system, and was made available, unfortunately, to individuals that were not authorized. The concern that the parent brought was that what can they do to ensure that the child's name, social security number, was not going to be used in some illicit way that could, in fact, impact the child and set up a situation that was not appropriate. For those who have served over the number of years,
Senator, could you identify yourself for the record?
Floyd Przonski, State Senator, District 4, parts of Lane and Douglas County.
I was trying to throw you off.
That's quite
go,
all right.
Go ahead.
I'll go right back to where I was. But for those who were here in 2007, you will remember that we passed Senate Bill 583, which became the Oregon Consumer Identity Protection, Theft Protection Act. This was one that actually put in place what an individual such as ourselves, an adult, can do in protecting and ensuring that your credit rating is not impacted by being able to freeze your credit reports and information if you choose to do so. So this is kind of a segue to that. Based on the technology that where we are now, we are basically trying to ensure that young people's sensitive financial information, such as their Social Security number, cannot be used against them or establishing illegal credit. So that's the first bill. And did you want to go ahead and continue, or?
Does anybody have questions on this one right now?
I I will say to the chair and for committee members, Mr. Marquis is here. Jim was one of the members. We had a group when we had the 2006 work group. We met for like 9 months, and we had about 30 to 40 different entities, private and public, that were involved. They made one catch on one of the issues, and we've taken care of that. But I believe he is standing here and will be available in the neutral position if there's any other questions for that one. And if that's takes care of that, Mr. Chair, I will move into Senate Bill 525.
Thank you.
And for the record, I'm Floyd Przanski, still Floyd Przanski, still Senator at this point, for District 4, parts of Lane and Douglas counties. Senate Bill 525 came to my attention when a reporter from the Argonian called me in the first part of December of 2012, asking me about whether or not I thought it was appropriate for district attorneys to allow their governmental seals to be used by third-party collection type of entities to send out demand letters to individuals that had written bad checks. I was somewhat surprised to hear that that was a practice, and I said, well, I'm not real up to this. I need some time to review it, and I'll call you back. So we spoke probably a week later after I was able to get the necessary information and determine that in statute today we do have what's known as the bad check diversion program. It's found at ORS 135.925, and this is a program that is within the district attorney's offices and allows a district attorney in his office or her office to establish a bad check diversion program. It sets out specific form that needs to be followed to actually carry out the program and stating what the do's and the don'ts are. What came to my attention after the article was printed in the Argonian was that a number of district attorney's offices have been using third parties to actually attempt to collect on bad checks that have been written. I'm not here to say that should not continue, but I do believe it's very important that everyone understands who they're dealing with when they're dealing with individuals. And Mr. Chair, I will hand to your committee administrator. What will be distributed to you now is a letter that is actually sent by an organization called Bounce Back. It is a national organization that collects on bad checks and other debts. In this case, as the district attorneys would say, restitution, even though there's not been a judgment entered, they're trying to collect where there's been a debt. Once you get this letter, you will see in the upper left-hand corner, the in this case, Lane County District Attorney's Check Enforcement Program. It actually provides the district attorney's address in there, and if you look to the upper right-hand side, you'll see the seal of the district attorney for Lane County being used plus his name. When you drop down, then you have in the bold print the warning and all of the notices, and you drop down, it says you can mail payment regarding after you are told that you need to make these payments, how you make the payments, actually to the district attorney's office. And when you get down to the last paragraph where it says to contact the check enforcement program, please call toll free, and then has a number. That number is not the district attorney's office. That number is the Bounce Back program. Nowhere on this letter does it state that you're dealing or you have received this letter from a third-party private enterprise. I believe it is imperative that we as a state have a program and a position policy that states that we are not going to allow for governmental seals or letterhead to be used by third parties in trying to collect on whatever it is. So, Mr. Chair, we did get an amendment, which is the Dash 4, A4 amendment that has been, I believe, distributed to the committee that actually has was through negotiations. The District Attorneys Association, through Alex Gardner, my district attorney, asked that we basically take out the language that was in the A and Gross as it pertains to bad check or debt collection, and instead leave the program intact as it currently is written, but understand that there needs to be transparency and just put the prohibition for any agencies or programs that are state-affiliated to using a seal or name of a public entity in attempting to collect. Now, I have seen, I believe it's from Polk County, District Attorney Brad Berry has a similar program where he actually sends a cover letter with the program information stating that they have contracted with a third-party entity to tell them this is who you will be dealing with. I have no problem with that. That is full disclosure, transparency, and everyone can live with that. But when we have someone actually sending out and representing, I believe this letter shows a misrepresentation that someone is getting a letter from a governmental agency, in this case a state executive office, the district attorney, that's wrong. And so what we're asking at this point is for the committee to adopt the dash A4s and replace the bill. It will be warmly received on the Senate side, and it will in fact take care of this practice not only in the context of district attorneys, but any other state agency or local government agency who may be in the practice of allowing their governmental seal or their letterhead to be used for those purposes.
Thank you. It was a pretty specific presentation of the bill. Questions from the committee? Senator, I just real quick. I mean, it sounds like I'm struggling. Are they hiring debt collectors to do this? Is this debt collection or is it not debt collection? I guess I'm struggling a little bit with that concept. And if so, are these third parties that are working for the state agency, are they licensed debt collectors in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I can't answer that question for you as to how Bounce Back would be labeled or identified in this state or any other state as to the practice. What I can tell you is that the district attorney said that the entities that they are hiring to do this work have litigated this in different states, I believe, and maybe on a national level, and that it has been determined that they are basically collecting restitution. Now, I would tell you that if you look in Oregon's law, my interpretation of restitution is based on where there's been a conviction entered, and then the court is saying, as part of your punishment, you are supposed to do that. Now, so I'm not going to go there. I do know there was an article in today's Oregonian that's a follow-up, same reporter that contacted me going over some of the latest news on this particular bill, and I believe maybe some other information that he's come up with that may give you a little bit more clarity, but I have not researched it. I did tell the district attorney that I was willing to strip out everything that they're concerned with, but leaving in the rest and allowing the agencies to make a determination as to whether they can or can't enter into that. I think DCBS may have some interest in this, and my understanding from the article today, the Department of Justice had a complaint that was filed and that they dropped the complaint based on the district attorney's office that was involved in that investigation stating they had authorized the use. So what I do know is that if this bill passes with the A4s, that ability to authorize the use of a government seal or letterhead will no longer be allowed.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I don't see any questions for you, and I know you had a 2 o'clock, so I tried to get you done. You're just a minute late or so.
That's quite all right.
So thank you very much for bringing these forward to us and explaining them to us.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for your time.
And Mr. Marquis, did you want to say anything on the other bill before I close this public hearing? Okay. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 574 and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 525 and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 558. And Sybil and Emily, could we have you back? And I believe we were done with Sybil's testimony, were we not, Bob?
I think so.
Yes.
We had a few questions of you, but let's go ahead and get Emily's testimony. If you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Emily Ryman. I'm the Opportunity Works Manager for NEDCO, which is a community development corporation serving Lane, Marion, and Clackamas counties, and we are the foreclosure counseling provider for those counties. I'm here today to talk to you not so much about the specifics of the bill, but about the realities on the ground that we're seeing with the clients that we serve. deserve and the foreclosure crisis as we see it, and why we think that Senate Bill 558A and this mediation program are so very crucial to our clients and to your constituents. Foreclosure counseling as it at its core is really around to help homeowners understand their current situation and the options that are available for them moving forward, and then to help them navigate what is an incredibly complex and often very dysfunctional system to try to get to an alternative other than foreclosure. We are, as a lot, a pretty conservative bunch, so although we are consumer advocates, we also understand that mortgages are a contract and that not every family is going to be able to continue making payments and stay in their home. We are just as apt to counsel somebody toward a graceful exit from their home as we are to counsel them toward a modification or some other means to keep their home. We've been providing foreclosure counseling since 2008, since the beginning of this crisis, but there are a few things that have changed recently in our world. One of those, obviously, is the rise of judicial foreclosures. And judicial foreclosure on its own actually provides some good oversight for that process, and it's not something that, it's something that counseling can work with, just as we can with a non-judicial foreclosure. But there are a couple of hurdles to clients in the judicial foreclosure process, namely in the timeline that they are given for an initial response to the summons and complaint, which is 30 days. And quite frankly, for the average homeowner, for the average consumer, they don't know what a summons and complaint is. If they open it and read it at all, they don't know what it means, and they don't know how to respond to it. We as counseling agencies are trying to increase our outreach. We're trying to do direct mailings and even some door-to-door knocking to people who we know have received a judicial foreclosure, but we're working against that same 30-day time clock. So it's very difficult to help homeowners understand their options and the resources available to them in that time. Legal aid, we're working very closely with, but they are already overwhelmed by the number of people needing assistance, and a lot of homeowners can't afford to hire a private attorney to help them make that response. So it's difficult to help them by the time that they need to try to work a solution other than a foreclosure out with that servicer before the clock runs out on them. Another thing that we're seeing is the much more common practice of selling loan pools and selling servicing rights. So we are not infrequently working with clients right now who come to us as maybe a Bank of America client or a Wells Fargo client, and we help them try to submit a modification application or reach another workout, and just as we're finally making headway on that process, the servicing rights are sold to another servicer, which theoretically doesn't need to disrupt the entire process, but it oftentimes does in practice. So we may spend 8 or 12 months working with one servicer and to no resolution, and then we have to start from ground zero when that loan is transferred to a new servicer. So that's a frustrating and seemingly very increasing practice. Add to that all of the traditional horror stories that you've heard throughout the foreclosure crisis about paperwork being lost and delayed and about homeowners not being able to get through on the phone and all the other logistical problems that were already in place with the servicing industry, and you just get a compounding challenge of counselors trying to help homeowners reach a solution other than foreclosure. It works occasionally. We do have success, and we see homeowners get very reasonable modifications, and we see them be able to stay current on those and stay in their homes long term. The problem is that it doesn't work for most. It might work for one homeowner, and for the next 19 who walk through our door, it doesn't work, and then it works for another one. And we can't figure it out. We can't figure out what it is that makes the stars align about any given case that makes it work well for one homeowner and not for the others. Except that we do know that there are a lot of variables involved, and we watch them on a day-to-day basis not line up correctly. It ends up being a little bit of a game of roulette for homeowners. They have to have a servicer who has a functioning loss mitigation department and that doesn't change mid-process. They have to be assigned to a customer service representative who actually answers the phone and answers the phone more than once. They have to have a fax machine that doesn't apparently fax to the ether but is actually connected to another fax machine. They have to submit extensive documentation packages without a single error or a single thing missing, and sometimes the documents that are requested come directly from left field. We don't really know where. They have to assume that the underwriters are working with their most recent documents and not the documents they submitted 12 months ago when they first tried to apply for a modification. You can imagine the nightmare that this turns into for homeowners, for counselors, for everybody involved in the system. The great thing about mediation is that it's not actually introducing very much new to this system. It's not asking servicers to issue workout solutions that they don't already work with every day. It's not imposing timelines or standards that don't already exist on the national stage. All it's trying to do is give us a chance to pull all of those many variables and all of the people associated with them into a single room at a single table on a single day so that we can try to make all of those stars align for more homeowners than it does right now. And I want to reiterate also that, as Sybil Hebb said earlier, we're not expecting outrageous solutions. We're not expecting every homeowner who goes to mediation to keep their home. We just want them to get a final answer. We want homeowners who have stable income and who have a chance to repay their mortgage to be able to stay in that home. And we want homeowners who want to exit that home to have a chance to do that. We actually work with homeowners who come to counseling because they just want the bank to take the home back, and they can't seem to make that happen. So that also, in our mind, is a perfectly reasonable outcome to a mediation. My only concern actually for this program is that it may not go quite far enough. Ms. Hebb mentioned earlier the uncertainty around the exemptions. And just in pulling some numbers of NEDCO's current clients and the first quarter of foreclosures that were filed in our counties, probably 30 to 40% of our current clients are right now with national servicers, not small banks and credit unions, who are not the big five. And it's those national servicers who aren't the big five where we just really don't know where they're going to fall. So depending on where they fall in that exemption, we could be facing telling a pretty significant chunk of our clients that, we're sorry, you don't actually qualify for mediation, not because you've had success in trying to get to a workout, but because your servicer happens to be exempt. We're also faced with the very real possibility that a client who came to us, who 2 weeks ago had their home loan with Bank of America and would have qualified, had it recently sold to a servicer who is exempt and no longer does, or who may actually have already started the mediation program with one of the servicers, and their loan is transferred midway, and they're suddenly with an exempt servicer and cannot continue. And, you know, that it's a major concern, but it's a concern based in my belief that this mediation program is so vital and so important and is what homeowners need. I would just want to see it apply to as many homeowners as we can possibly make it. Thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting testimony. Questions?
Yes, I have a question. Thank you about the exemption. Do you think that the banks are doing that at all intentionally so that they can offload?
I hate to make assumptions about the intentions of the banks, but I don't think it wouldn't surprise me if that becomes a system that they figure out a way to game.
So was there a lot follow-up, please?
Follow-up.
Is there a lot of discussion about that number and whether the 175 is correct or whether there are other sideboards that should be put on that?
Absolutely.
Whether, for instance, if it started with one servicer, then the exemption would not apply if it was transferred, I won't say offloaded, transferred to somebody who would fall under that exemption?
Sure. Representative Kenny Geyer, I can also let Sybil take this. There has been much discussion about that number, and quite frankly speaking, for NEDCO and the counseling agencies, we would probably like to see it about 25. But we also have a vested interest in seeing this move forward quickly. I mean, we want this legislation, we want this mediation program, and we know that every day that ticks by, there are more and more foreclosures filed with people who are not eligible for it. So it's a difficult position for us to take.
And Chair Holvey, Representative Kenny Geyer, the only thing I would add to that is that in the part of what we struggle with is
Sybil, could you introduce
Sybil
yourself
with
again?
The Oregon Law Center. Part of what we struggled with in trying to determine what is the right number is that we don't have access to information that allows us to know how many foreclosures did Nation Star, for example, and just picking a name out of the hat, file in Oregon last year, without combing through every single county's records and looking at all of those filings. We've begun to try to do that a little bit, but we haven't been able to get those exact numbers statewide. We have an idea, and we think the number is too high. One thing that we think will help with passage of this bill, especially as it gets out there quickly and we see how it works, is that when people begin filing their affidavits of exemption, the law now requires that they not simply say, I did less than X. They say, I did less than X. This is how many I did. And so we'll get a better sense of where people fall. So
other questions? So along those lines, I'm curious, just a fundamental question. So when a lender or beneficiary uses a loan servicer, they actually sell the loan product to the loan servicer, so the loan servicer then becomes a beneficiary?
I'm going to pitch that one to Kelly Harpster.
Or maybe somebody else can answer that, too, if you don't want. It's, you know, because I imagine some lenders or beneficiaries will use different loan servicers.
Chair Holby.
Or multiple, perhaps.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, the bill itself applies to beneficiaries who are foreclosing and their affiliates and their subsidiaries. And I will also defer to Kelly about that distinction, if that's okay.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for getting us going on this subject matter.
That's what they do. Change the beneficiary.
Angela Martin and Marie Strasbaugh. Probably said that wrong.
I didn't say it just fine. Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Martin with Economic Fairness Oregon. Let me echo everyone in saying thank you for taking so much time with this issue. I also want to echo the sentiments of Senator Boquist. I started working on this issue 6 years ago. If I can stop working on this tomorrow, I will be forever grateful. and certainly the families who have been living this for the 5 and 6 years will certainly be grateful to know that homeowners will finally see some resolution. I'm going to keep my comments brief and touch on 3 points and add to what has been said. Number one, we know that the foreclosure crisis is not over. In my testimony, I include a chart from the Mortgage Settlement Oversight Office that includes a loan portfolio from the 5 largest servicers. And this report was offered up the beginning of this year. What this shows is that nearly 40,000 first lien loans held by those big 5 servicers are in delinquency, bankruptcy, or foreclosure status. We are concerned, because of issues that you've just heard, that the exemption combined with changes in the market are going to mean that many of those homeowners are simply not going to have this program available to them should you decide to pass this bill. I'll point out that Oregon is one of the few states that has mediation that chose to have an exemption. And as we've heard, the exemption was intended to offer low-volume servicers, Oregon credit unions, community banks, nonprofit affordable housing providers, an opportunity to opt out of this program if they would choose to. However, as it's structured, the exemption, we fear, will exclude a number of homeowners who are being traded by the Big 5 to what are emerging as the new Big 10 national servicers. Let me give you an Oregon example. In February 2013, Ally Bank, one of the Big 5, reported that it had 30,000 loans in its Oregon portfolio, 30,000 first lien loans. Nearly 10% of those loans were reported to be at risk, in default, or already in foreclosure. In March, Ally announced that it agreed to sell its remaining portfolio to Ocwen and Quicken Loans, pushing Quicken into the rank of the top 10 servicers in the United States. However, based on how we've structured the exemption for 2013, we will look at 2012 and ask how many what was the foreclosure volume of Ocwen and Quicken? Well, for the last quarter in the Tri-County area, the last quarter of 2012, Ocwen foreclosed on 3 individuals, and in the first quarter of this year in the Tri-County area, 16 foreclosures. Quicken, in the last quarter, Tri-County area, had 0 foreclosures and 2 in the first quarter, again, Tri-County, foreclosure actions. We know that the volume is going to pick up, but what we don't know is will we be able to capture them with the way the exemption is currently structured. I'll end with a positive. We know foreclosure mediation works. We know this because 25 other jurisdictions have implemented these programs and have taught us how to be successful. My testimony includes a couple of charts of states that have really gotten it right. And to be successful, a mediation program has to be designed to do 2 things correctly. Number one, they have to get people to attend. And then once they're there, they have to facilitate good outcomes. I know that a lot of thought and time and energy has gone into structuring Oregon's programs to produce good results on both ends. We look to states like, for example, Philadelphia. They certainly got both pieces right. They have high participation rates and high rates of agreement. An empirical study, actually one of the only empirical studies that was done of mediation programs, shows us that 70% of eligible homeowners attended mediation 35% of those conferences resulted in a workout that allowed the homeowner to remain in their home. 2 years later, 80% of the homeowners with a mediated agreement were still in their home. So this is good for the lender, good for the community, obviously good for the homeowner. I also included a chart about Connecticut. This program is one of the most successful at achieving agreements. 82% of mediations ended with an agreement. Two-thirds of borrowers who attended those mediations reached an agreement to stay in their home. Finally, the qualitative research conducted shows us that mediation makes both parties happy. The lender, the homeowner, both report feelings of satisfaction and justice at greater rates than those that do not participate in the process. I'll end by again saying thank you. I know this has been a difficult conversation for many. I echo the sentiment that as soon as we can get this into place, we will start helping more individuals and take any questions you may have as I turn it over to you.
Good afternoon. My name is Marie Strasbaugh, and this is my husband, William. And he is a distinguished veteran who was awarded 2 Purple Hearts for his service in 2 wars. And we have always managed our finances, and we have in our married life bought 5 homes. In 2006, we purchased a home through Fidelity, which is a very respectable establishment. And right away, they sold our contract, and then the trouble started. They couldn't find a payment, and then they charged late fees. And then our home was, the mortgager sold it again, and we found out that it was owned by one mortgage company, all these mortgage companies. So every time they sold our house, they made a profit. Every time they sold our house to another one, and it was the same company. We went through a lot. We were scared. We got threats. And we are older, and we didn't know what to do. So we went to several lawyers, tried to get advice, called Oregon Attorney General, and finally we had our paperwork and done an autopsy on it through a private investigator. And he went through and investigated all the paperwork. He found fraud, and he found discrepancies and robot signatures, falsified names. And so we felt like we had enough proof, you know, but it didn't work. So we had to go Chapter 13, even though we were still paying our house payments. And then our lawyer told us not to pay the house payments, to go through the 13. But we were too scared not to, so we kept on, because that was bad advice. And so it put it, mentally, it was a strain on us. He had heart trouble, and we were scared every day that they were going to come take our house. And this is my second trip to Salem to help pass this, because people need modifications. We never thought it happened to us. We never thought in a million years, because Fidelity was a very nice company. But it happens to people in all kinds. And it wasn't fair to us, because we kept paying our house payment. And we were treated terribly. So we finally got the HARP program and went through modification with a company, a mortgage company in India. And finally, the nightmare is over with for us. And we're able to stay in our house.
Go ahead, there. Well, as you told you, I'm a veteran, Vietnam, Gulf War. I'm here because of the F word, foreclosure.
And if you'd state your name too, if you would, please.
I'm sorry, I'm William Strasbaugh.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I just wanted to reiterate on what she had said. I wrote the Comptroller General. We called the FBI. We took the paperwork that we were getting from the courts, sent it to Bank of America, asked them, what can we do? How can we do it? They wrote back and said, we don't know who the hell you are. Stop bothering us. So I sent her more paperwork, and we went. She called, and we talked to two CEOs of Bank of America, and they said, we don't know who you are. Well, I had all this paperwork with Bank of America, this outfit in Seattle that was representing them. We called them. They didn't exist. They turned it over to somebody else. We called them. Every month we got a letter from them. They were taking money out of our account for this and for that and everything else. Well, to make a long story short, we finally got our modification after about four tries, and everything's gone well for us. But all I want to say in all this and our support of this bill is when you go home tonight, look your wife and your kids in the face and say, I don't have a job. We can't afford our house. We're going to have to live in the car. We're going to have to go live with mom and dad or grandma. Think about it. It's not easy. Kids should not live in a shelter. That's not what it's about. We shouldn't have Oregonians living in tents. I mean, come on. Give it some thought. That's all I'm asking. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Thatcher.
I know that. I think it was dash 20 something I was hearing it was finally adopted, which tells you there's been a lot of work. But just throwing this out there, because I know there's been some concern raised over the exemption issue. Why not figure out something, not now, I'm just like during the interim, figure out some way of allowing anybody to apply for that if they meet those certain parameters. I think Sybil was mentioning, okay, we expect they're here, they're answering the phone, they're, you know, doing these things, and if they maybe meet those types of specifications, figure that out, and then allow anybody to apply for that through affidavit as it is set up now, unless there's some other method that is dreamt up, Representative Smith. So.
We're all ears. Other questions? You care to respond, or?
Chair Holvey, Representative Thatcher, perhaps for the interim of discussion, I will offer that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, charged with developing an exemption for their the rules that they oversee for the country, came up with a more exact approach that looked at the size of a institution's portfolio. And so you really were saying, oh, you're that small community bank or that small credit union versus the volume of their foreclosures, which is subject to all these variables that we've discussed. So perhaps for the interim, I think there are different approaches that might be contemplated.
Thank you. I certainly appreciate your testimony and bringing forward and sharing with us your experiences as well. I think they're valuable experiences for us to hear. I hope you have a good afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Up next, I'm going to hear from Paul Cosgrove and Teresa Schill.
Mr. Chair, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Bankers Association, Independent Community Banks of Oregon, and the Oregon Financial Services Association. To date, the testimony you've heard has to do with mediation and modification. And I'll just say one thing with respect to that. Senate Bill 558 is a dramatic improvement over what we thought was a relatively flawed bill that passed in the February session. Unfortunately, the model that was used in Senate Bill 1552 in February was the Nevada mediation program, and it had major problems, and I think everybody agreed that was true. We didn't get everything we needed, frankly, in the discussions about mediation modification, but I think we've got enough that the system will work. What I am here to talk about is two other provisions in Senate Bill 1552 that were not modified by Senate Bill 558. They don't deal with mediation. They deal with other changes made in that bill, and they affect every kind of lender, whether it be a big bank, small bank, credit union, or an individual. And the first one I want to discuss with you is the change made in the definition of a residential trust deed. You would think that is a relatively simple thing to define in that it's a residence. But our definition in Oregon of a residential trust deed has always had two components. One of the components was what kind of property it was, and Oregon defines that as a 1-to-4 residential property. Very logical, very standard. But it also, it depends on who is residing in the property. And in Oregon, a residential trust deed is only that because it is the place where the grantor of the trust deed, the borrower, either he or she and or his or her spouse and or their children live in one of the units. So who's living in the house is important. And if you think about the lending process, any lender probably only knows 2 or 3 times in the process of the term of a loan who's in the house. The first time they know who's in the house is when they make the loan. And those of you who've had home loans, you know that one of the typical things you have to state as part of the lender's process is this going to be your residence or is this going to be a rental property? Is it an investment property? The second time, if the loan is in default, that the lender will know who is residing in the property is when the foreclosure property process starts and papers are served on the occupants, in which case you know who's residing in the property. And the last time is when the foreclosure sale happens and you find out who's residing in the property. We used to define residential trust deed and based on who was residing at the property at the time the foreclosure sale was held. That's a definable time. It worked. Advocates said that wasn't a good time to define because people might be caught in a catch-22. So the definition was changed to who resided in the property at the time of the first default under the loan which started the foreclosure. And again, if you think about your own loans, you're required to pay property taxes, you're required to keep insurance, you're required to make monthly payments. The first default might be the late payment of property taxes or the first time you were down 30 days in a payment even though you continue to make payments. It can date back many, many years. And for a lender's perspective, we won't know who was residing in the property, whether it was a rental property at the time or an owner-occupied property at the time at that point. So our request has always been to find a definable time when all the parties can determine who is in the property. Why is this important? A whole lot of provisions of Oregon's trust deed law flow from whether it is a residential trust deed or not. What kinds of notices and the timing of notices all flow from that. So we are still seeking an additional amendment to the provisions that were passed in February to define residential trust deed at one of those 3 times. And the one we have proposed to the advocates, and I think they are considering, is defining it as a residential trust deed at the time the loan was made. That's when everybody knows what's going on. Everybody states that it's a residence or not. If the borrower moves out and becomes a rental property, it would still be a residential trust deed for the purposes of the protections of the statute. If the borrower stayed, it would still be a residential trust deed. But if it started as an investment property and was underwritten by the lender as an investment property, it would stay an investment property. So that's one issue. The second issue I just want to touch on briefly has to do with an issue that arose in response to a question to Representative Smith. The provision for the $500 penalty with respect to that notice, actually if that notice is required of all lenders of all kinds, including individuals, whether or not they've been through the mediation process. That too is a provision that has nothing to do directly with mediation. It might apply to all the people who did go through mediation, but it also applies to all the people who were exempted from mediation because they were individuals or only had one foreclosure or anything else. So it is a matter of concern for us as well. With that, you've heard a lot about the details. I'm happy to discuss which of those you wish. I've spent more hours talking to more people on this in terms of negotiating over the last 2 sessions that I feel that my life has become as, I'm going to get as hair as gray as Senator Boquist. Actually, oh gosh, mine's already too gray, more gray than that. But that all happened since we started this issue. But with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this concern up. And I assume that part of the concern is the deficiency judgment issue. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, Residential trust deed defines whether you have a deficiency or not, yes. It also defines whether you have to give the provision, the notice that has the $500 penalty or not. And it also has to do with how you set over or postpone the sale. It's different for residential. Commercial trust deed foreclosures are handled differently than residential ones. So it has several different implications throughout the process.
Just want to make sure that I understand. For instance, if a person has defaulted and they've moved out of the property, but they get an opportunity to rent the property while they're gone. You know, I mean, they moved in with mom, but somebody wants to rent it, and so they do that. And then the foreclosure proceeding begins. But at that time, would it be viewed as a rental property presently? Or would it be a residential property that wouldn't be subject to a deficiency judgment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, under the current law definition that we changed in February, under those circumstances, it might very well be considered, depending on when the default was, if they moved out at the time of the default, a commercial loan for which there would be a deficiency. Under the provision we're proposing, it would not be, because it would be defined as a residential property back at the beginning of the loan. So ours would be more protective of homeowners who are buying homes, even if they later move out and rent them.
Okay, that's what I'm perceiving from what you're saying. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we might want to consider accepting that kind of an amendment so that because when you make the loan, if it's a residential property, it's a residential property. You know it at that point. If it's going to be a rental, everybody knows it's going to be a rental. But under what is being, you know, what we currently have, if there's a change in circumstances, and a home that has a $200,000 loan on it is really only worth $100,000. If it's commercial property, then theoretically, that the difference between its value at the foreclosure sale and what it was, the loan, could be, the commercial entity could go and seek to get that deficiency from the person who can't afford the home to begin with. Where if this amendment that's being requested were to be granted, then if it's a residential property at the time that the loan is made, then there would be no deficiency possibility, even if there were weird circumstances that are taking place toward the end of this whole process that leads to foreclosure. Right. So it just made it sound like that makes sense, and it wouldn't seem to be something that would be controversial for anybody, and it'd be an easy fix. But just want to mention that to you.
Thank you. And Mr. Cosgrove, I know you... I didn't see any written testimony from you or the Bankers Association about these specific concerns. Did these concerns come up on the Senate side?
Mr. Chairman, there were perhaps 50 or 60, maybe I'm overestimating, we'll say many concerns that came up on the Senate side. Some got fixed, others did not get fixed. The specific proposal to move the definition of residential trustee back to the time of the loan did not come up then. It has come up since. I've had discussions with Sybil Hebb. I've even provided her within the last couple of days some proposed exact language to accomplish that in terms of the definitional change, and she's considering it.
So following up on that, specifically where in this bill does that change to the residential loan take place that you're discussing?
Mr. Chair, this bill affects several sections, some new sections and some old sections of a series of laws, ORS 86, 705 through 795. The particular definition section isn't affected in this bill. It was affected in 1552. It would most certainly fit within the relating clause of this bill. It relates to how you define a residential trustee for foreclosure and all these other purposes.
So it's not in this particular bill that your issue is not. So are there other vehicles relating to trust deeds, I assume, in the legislature as well?
Mr. Chairman, there is only one other bill that is a possible vehicle. It is ironically the House version of Senate Bill 558, which is sitting in Rules. I'm vehicle agnostic about the change. I think the change, though, is important. And it's
there may be many that are not vehicle agnostic is the reason I bring that up.
I understand that.
It'd be helpful if you could give us something in writing that can lay this out for us a little bit better.
Chairman, I was negotiating with some folks and trying to see if we could reach agreement on what the language would be before doing that, but I can be happy to send to your committee administrator the proposed language.
Great.
Thank you.
Chair, can I ask a question?
Certainly. Representative Kindergartner.
Thank you. And I'm not sure if you represent the in-state and out-of-state banks, but I'm just wondering how you feel about the number of 175 as the number for exemption, whether there could be any difference between an out-of-state bank versus an in-state, whether it's got to be the same number, whether you know whether it could, it's possible that if it originates, because you're talking about originating with the person living in the home at the time of the loan, whether this procedure originates with a particular bank, whether it could stay with that bank, or the exemption could not be, if there was no exemption on the first bank, if there would not be allowed an exemption on subsequent banks if it got traded.
Your general
reaction to all of that.
Mr. Chairman, you've raised a couple of different issues. Let me just make sure this definition of residential trustee does not apply.
No, it's exactly.
A different
I'm
question.
I'm going back to the exemption issue.
The quick answer is no one knows how many foreclosures are done by any institution, except that we have surveyed our major members, meaning the bigger banks, and they are so far above 175 that it really doesn't matter which figure. What this really does is potentially affect some of the smaller community banks, and most of those are considerably below that.
Sure.
This issue was also debated in Olympia this last legislative session. There was the same proposal there to reduce from 250 to 100, and not saying that you necessarily have to follow the guidance of your neighbors to the north, but they decided to stay with 250. In the Senate, we decided to negotiate between 250 and 100 and end up 175. But the truth of the matter is, no one really knows which institutions, with some clear examples of people who are clearly under and some clear examples of people who are clearly over, we don't know in the middle necessarily who's there.
And thank you. I'm going to go ahead and get your testimonies. We're running short of time, have a few more people to testify, so I want to get you on the record, please.
Chairman Hovey and committee. My name is Teresa Schell. I'm a lawyer located in Portland, Oregon, and I have been practicing mortgage banking for about 10 years, and in that 10 years I prosecuted a lot of judicial foreclosures. I'm here for the United Trustees Association, the UTA. It's a national nonprofit that provides information, expertise, and opinions on trustee issues and practices. The UTA membership is comprised of those acting as trustees under real property deeds of trust, including employees of title companies, financial institutions, and independent companies. The UTA would like to see clarification on some of the provisions of SB 1558A, which would mandate mediation prior to the filing of a judicial foreclosure of a residential trustee. First, SB 1558A requires a copy of a certificate of compliance to be attached and be made part of a complaint when filing for a judicial foreclosure. But it also sets out a one-year expiration of that certificate. The judicial foreclosure process usually takes more than 1 year to complete. And there are circumstances where judicial foreclosure may be dismissed by order of the court rather than voluntarily by the plaintiff. And Section 5B of SB 1558A doesn't adequately address this reality and is ambiguous to the intent and effect of this one-year expiration. The verbiage of Section 5B can be interpreted in two ways. First, the interpretation is that the certificate must be valid at the time the complaint is filed and must remain so throughout the duration of the case. If this is the case, the plaintiff would need to start over and go through the mediation process again to get a valid certificate if the judicial foreclosure action is not resolved within 1 year.
If you could summarize, because we can read your testimony, you're just reading us the written testimony, so if you just summarize real quick.
Well, the other interpretation is that that there's no consequence to the expiration of the certificate. But in practice, there is. A judicial foreclosure does usually take longer than 1 year. There are circumstances, especially in today's environment, where cases are commonly dismissed. And why that happens is lawyers tend to call it like the one-year rule. So in Oregon, you're to bring your case to either resolution or trial within 1 year of its filing. And then there's some moving deadlines that occur within there. Under Rule 7 of the Uniform Trial Court Rules, this is a 63-day notice in which you have to have all your defendants actually served, or your case could be dismissed if you don't file a motion to show good cause why it should be continued. And then also there's a 91-day Rule 7 notice, which indicates that you have defaulted defendants, but you have to enter a judgment. Those are being interpreted very strictly nowadays. and continuances are not liberally granted. So we're seeing a much higher volume of cases simply being dismissed in these sort of housekeeping rules of no fault to the plaintiff. Because often in judicial foreclosure, the people, your defendants are not, are more than just the grantor. And the grantor is sort of a known quantity, you know, generally where they live because they're a party to the contract and you have information that you can use to find them. But other lien holders might be small claim judgment holders. There might be other judgment liens from collection agencies and so forth. There's junior trustees. And sometimes those parties are harder to find, and so it takes longer to actually affect service process, which is the delivery of the summons complaint to them under the rules, under the ORCPs.
Thank you. I'd like to go ahead and wrap up and get two more people on the record. And we have your testimony. And if you have some suggestions for us, we're probably going to have another vetting of this bill as well. So I'm going to get a couple more people on the record, and we'll have some more discussion. So up next, I'd like to have Kelly Harpster and Janet Borth. And I apologize for the shortness that we've walked into again, but we'll have another opportunity. And so if you could introduce yourself and maybe summarize your testimony for today, and we'll get into more details later.
Sure. My name is Kelly Harpster, and I'm an attorney in private practice. I represent homeowners with mortgage and foreclosure issues. I'm also a member of the Advisory Committee for the Foreclosure Avoidance Mediation Program. I was one of the trainers that traveled across the state training our foreclosure mediators. I've also helped train our housing counselors for this program and done attorney CLEs to prepare attorneys to participate in this program. And then, of course, I've been intimately involved in the process of trying to approve this program, which ultimately resulted in this bill. Did you want to, let me let Janet introduce herself in case she wants to jump in on a technical question here.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Janet Borth. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice. I've been doing a lot of work on the legal issues associated with the program, and I'm here solely to answer any technical questions from the committee.
Chair, and I understand that we're out of a lot of time. I've given you some written testimony that talks about, you know, generally why I think you should support this bill and what we've tried to do. Just to summarize that very briefly, this bill was in part the product of the improvements that came forward and that people talked about, came from months of discussions from the advisory committee, from the actual experiences of running the mediation program for a period of time, and from what is now actually a vast body of literature about how to properly design a foreclosure mediation program that works and produces good results and balances the competing interests of lenders and homeowners, and frankly, there are many other stakeholders involved in a process like this, which is what makes a bill like this so difficult to do when you have so many different groups involved. It's very difficult to find a provision that makes everybody happy. So we try to balance those things out. And I think you'll see, and I think the, you know, it sounds like Mr. Cosgrove was recognizing as well that despite the fact everybody's not perfectly satisfied, the Senate worked very hard to try to additionally balance out those issues. We took a lot of input as folks were making recommendations about what should be in a bill like this, also from lenders and trustees and folks in the title insurance industry and consumer advocates and housing counselors and mediators and many others. So this really is a group product of what the best practices should look like, but in a real-world setting. I wanted to address quickly something Mr. Cosgrove asked about, which was the definition of residential trust deed. There's actually, this would actually be the fourth change if we make an additional change in the history of the statute. And this has always been a troublesome provision for the definition of residential trust deed. It started out originally, it was at the time a foreclosure was completed. And it worked for a while, and then banks noticed that homeowners, actually, in that case, were gaming the system. Folks that the legislature didn't intend to cover, that weren't living in the property as their primary residence, foreclosure would be commenced, they'd move back in, and they'd get deficiency protection. That wasn't the intent, and so the legislature came back and changed it. As you know, up until recently, judicial foreclosures have been the exception in the state, so we haven't seen a lot of them, so these problems really didn't develop again until the foreclosure crisis, and they had changed the definition until at the time the foreclosure was commenced, and then we started to see the banks gaming the system a bit. And we saw homeowners who would move out of their properties after trying to work with their lenders and not being able to get a short sale approved or not being able to get a loan modification or get a response on a loan modification, and they'd move on. In some cases, the foreclosure would be commenced, the nonjudicial foreclosure, and they would move out. And when they did, the banks would rescind the notice of default and start a judicial foreclosure where there was potential deficiency exposure. So word went out across the state that if you move out of your home at any time before the foreclosure is complete, which could take you a year or two, try to move on with your lives, get your kids resettled, take a new job, you might face deficiency exposure. That's not what the legislature ever intended either. So last session, you amended the bill. So now there's a new proposal. I don't think in principle it's an idea not worth exploring. The problem is we're now at this late date. We have other vehicles where we could explore that. This is the fourth time since 1960. You really want to get it right if you're going to change it again. Not only do lenders need certainty, but homeowners need certainty. So I think if you're going to do it, you want to sit down and explore it and make sure you've got it right. This bill needs to move at some point. We have thousands of homeowners facing foreclosure, 1,300 filings a month, and we're in year two where we have this great program, but folks can't use it. And so we really need to close those loopholes. So we should explore that option, just not in this particular bill. And there is another appropriate vehicle where we can work with Mr. Cosgrove to figure out what the right answer there is.
Thank you. I appreciate that testimony. I apologize for being short to those who didn't fully get a chance to give their full testimony. I hope to be able to have this conversation again before this committee's done with this subject matter. I don't know if anybody has any quick questions, but it would have to be very quick.
Very quick. First of all, Mr. Chair, I think that this is a good bill. We want it to go through. I think that it's needed. If there's a chance that there'd be a problem with making an amendment that would tie it up because it has to go onto the Senate side, then maybe we ought to look at a different vehicle, but I would hope that that could be done. The fact that it's been changed a few times since 1960, our laws have changed many times. I don't think that that should be holded up. But if we could move it ahead with another vehicle, I'd be happy to see that happen as well. One way or another, this bill needs to go forward.
Thank you. And I just have one fundamental, really basic question that's probably not very technical. So in this mediation foreclosure process with the counselors and all of that, who's actually required to be in the mediation in the conversation with the homeowner and the beneficiary? And can that conversation be expanded at somebody's choice to others?
Chair Holby, the way these work, and not just in Oregon, but all across the United States, is very similar. In fact, pretty much identical. And that's that typically appearing in person is usually a local attorney or a trustee for the servicer, for the actual, we'll say the beneficiary, but in reality we're really talking about loan servicers, the person you make your payment to every month, the person that the homeowner's used to dealing with, that's been dealing with on the loan modification. They're off in a center in California or somewhere else, depending on their location. They'll call in person. They'll have a workout specialist, is typically what they're called, available by telephone, who will be sort of pulling things up quickly on a computer. And then somebody, a local representative, will have to appear in person so that you have a live person there when the phone drops out, when you can't get a hold.
That's on the beneficiary side.
That's on the beneficiary side. On the grantor side, the homeowner obviously has to be there and participate. Sometimes you'll have joint grantor situations. If you had more than one grantor, you typically would want them both there. There are some exceptions, and I'll give you a quick example.
I want to know who else, because I'm going to have to adjourn.
Those are the only folks that are required to be there.
So the counselors do not attend the mediation?
The housing counselors can attend the mediation if the homeowner wants them to, and assuming, of course, they have somebody available.
And attorneys for the grantors?
Absolutely. They can have an attorney present if they choose, at their own expense.
At their own expense?
Yes.
and they're in foreclosure.
Okay. Answers my questions. Thank you very much. I appreciate the attention. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 558A and adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.